Thank you, everyone, for joining us for our session on exchange-traded funds this afternoon. Before I start, our lawyers always get to have the first say. This slide is all our standard legal information. Probably most importantly, that this material has been produced for financial professionals only and not for public distribution. So there's three components to our presentation today. I'm going to start off by considering the new reality and what it's meant for exchange-traded funds. Have a look at the growth that we've witnessed around the world in exchange-traded funds, what's been driving this growth, and how this has translated into actual portfolios. And then I'm going to hand over to my colleague, Anthony Chan, who is our senior investment strategist based in Hong Kong, and he's going to do two things. Firstly, he's going to run through and build upon the portfolio construction framework, the theoretical framework that we put forward in our original research paper. And then probably more importantly, he's going to examine actual portfolio solutions that are available to advisors right here in Australia using ETFs that are listed on the Australian Stock Exchange. But firstly, the new reality, and I'm not going to spend too much time trying to define what that is. This whole conference is geared towards trying to answer that question. But I think what is apparent is the new reality has meant a new focus, or a renewed focus on some critical elements to portfolio construction. I don't think there's any doubt that there is a much greater emphasis on risk in portfolios at the moment, a much greater emphasis on the liquidity of these portfolios, a much greater emphasis on the transparency of the vehicle that advisors are choosing to implement their client portfolios. And of course, as we all know, there's a much greater emphasis on cost. And so all of these factors have contributed to the huge growth that we've seen in exchange-traded funds over the past few years. And what I've shown up here is what happened in 2008, where we saw roughly $200 billion move out of managed funds and roughly the same number move into exchange-traded funds. Now, I'm not suggesting for one moment that the money simply moved out of unlisted managed funds and into ETFs, but I think the key point from this slide is despite all of that market volatility that we witnessed last year, investors did seek comfort from exchange-traded funds, and principally the liquidity, the transparency, and the low cost that they bring to client portfolios. So how is this translated into actual portfolios? Well, what we've put up here is an actual portfolio that's constructed by an advisor in the US. It's a conservative portfolio by his definition, with a portfolio size of approximately $300,000. Now, typically this is the extreme of what we see. Typically we do not see ETFs used to construct entire portfolios. It's possible, but typically they're used in conjunction with another vehicle. And so with that in mind, at the very least today, our hope is that you leave here with the notion that ETFs can easily complement what you're already doing in your client portfolios. But I think what this slide does show is the vast array of choice available through exchange-traded funds. As you can see, this advisor's been able to slice and dice the portfolio both in equities and fixed income in a number of different ways. And so this kind of choice, this level of choice, we believe is coming to Australia. It might not be in this exact form, but more choice is definitely coming. And in fact, that choice is already starting to arrive. You know, we now have a number of ETFs that track precious metals on the ASX, put together by a company called ETF Securities. There are a number of ETFs that track the Australian equity market now, provided by State Street and Vanguard. But the vast majority of ETFs on the Australian stock market give investors exposure to global equity markets, be it developed equity or emerging market exposure. And that is what is going to be the focus of our presentation today, the global equities piece of the portfolio. It was the focus of our research paper, and it's the focus for our session today. So on that note, I'll hand over to my colleague, Anthony Chan, and he'll talk about portfolio construction with ETFs from a theoretical standpoint and a practical standpoint. Anthony's based in Hong Kong. He joined us in March this year. Previously, he was with Watson Wyatt, where he spent a number of years as a principal consultant advising institutional clients in Southeast Asia on matters related to portfolio construction. So please join me in welcoming Anthony.
When I was a kid, many, many years ago, I used to be pretty competitive, and one day my school ran a kite building competition. So I thought, that's great, I'll enter that. And I got my dad to come in too, make it a bit of a father and son thing. So we did a lot of research on what make the perfect kite, you know, read up on all our kite theory, and we built it. Then it came to the judgment day. Well, you know, the second and third prize was, you know, very innovative designs, flashy designs. I thought, oh, not in with a chance. But we won. We were so happy we won. Now, it was a beautiful, beautiful, and the judges' comments were, you know, that's a perfect quadrilateral kite. Love it, classic design. So it was a beautiful summer's evening in England. We do have beautiful summer's evenings in England, believe me. So we all went out to try and fly our kites. And so I was feeling a bit smug, so I thought, okay, I'll let everyone else go out first. And it came my turn. I threw up the kite ready to fly, and of course it fell straight to the ground. So what's the point of the story? The point is, we'd built the theoretically perfect kite, but it didn't fly. In the session today, ladies and gentlemen, we will go through some of the theory. You've probably read the paper that came with the conference today. But that theory, I'd like to put it forward just as a method of illustrating what we want to talk about, which is really how to implement portfolios in practice using ETFs. So most of the time we'll spend on the second part, which is, in practice, how would some of these portfolios actually have performed, and how would they actually do in practice. So with that, in addition to that, I'd like to put on one extra framework on top of the theory that was outlined in the paper. And that framework is to the core satellite frame on how to sort of construct a portfolio. Now, there's nothing new. I'm sure many of you are familiar with core satellite already. But I'd just like to highlight a few areas on how we've been thinking about core satellite in terms of construction. And I think the first thing is you've read much of the literature. A lot of the literature, when they talk about core satellite, really refer to, you know, passive-active. You know, I think when people think core satellite, it means passive-active. Well, I think that's true, but I think of it in terms of core risk and satellite risk rather than passive management and active management. So just explore that a little bit. In the core, the way I think of the core is it's your strategic benchmark. It's the strategic part of your portfolio that's designed to get you and your clients where you want to go. Shouldn't really change very much. Not necessarily passively managed. I mean, you should be at least be actively rebalancing that portfolio. I think that's something which people often forget, including the institutional investors we used to consult to. Often it will be index investments, but often, again, looking at some portfolios I've seen before, you often see portfolios which are 100% active managers, but to manage the risk, they give them very, very low tracking errors, right? So basically, the managers are forced to stick very, very close to the benchmark. So I would view those as very core managers. And again, if you're not giving them much leeway, they're looking pretty like index in that sense as well. So that's the core. And in a satellite, what do I mean by satellite? Well, it is active, so you could have active managers in your satellite. Typically, I think of it as those very high satellite managers taking high levels of active risk versus the benchmark. But I'd view in a satellite also potentially indexed investments. So although the index investments are obviously passive, they're active in the way that you can use them, so tactical bets. So they're going to be temporary investments. You're not going to hold them for the long term. They're just going to be used to either over or underweight the benchmark, slight tilts, or potentially include other exposures which aren't in your core set of investments at all. So that's how I'd like to think of this core and satellite thing. And in terms of constructing the portfolio, we'll go through a case study now. But what we're going to do is start with the core portfolio. And really, that's the first step, I think. That's the step I used to find the most difficult as a consultant, trying to figure out what does the client really want to achieve. You're going to ask them, what's your investment objective? It often turns into a very deep discussion. But that's the core portfolio. What we'll do then next is follow what we did in the paper, which is take a deeper look at the core portfolio and just ask the question, do we think we could do better than that standard core portfolio? Or in other words, can we optimize it in some way? Now, those of you familiar with the paper will realize we've just used a classic mean variance framework to do that optimization. I'm not suggesting in this session today that mean variance is the way to go. You know, there are a lot of criticisms and quite valid criticisms, I think, of the mean variance framework, but it's just used here for the purposes of illustration. You know, there are plenty of other potential frameworks you could use, and we could discuss that potentially later on. And finally, once you've optimized your core, what we'd like to look at is the possibility of adding satellite investments. I understand in some of the other sessions in the conference over the last couple of days, there's been a few sessions on, especially around emerging markets. You know, you hear a lot about China in the news. You know, some of your clients may be asking you, hey, you know, I like China. how about putting some of China into your portfolio? But obviously, whilst there's potential return, comes extra risk. So what do you do about that? So what I'd like to explore is, how much extra risk does adding a satellite investment really add to the portfolio? Okay, so we'll take a look at that. So let's start with what I understand from Tom is a typical core international equity portfolio. So as Tom said, we're just focusing on the international equity portion today. I understand a very common benchmark to use is MSCI MSCI World, or perhaps MSCI X Australia. So I think the first thing to keep the practical aspect on how you could implement that is to look at, well, how could you trade that idea of you just want to follow the MSCI World Index? One very simple way is simply to put together a basket of ETFs, which simply mimic the market weight. So broadly speaking, 50-50 between, I've used the Australian ticker symbols here for the iShares, so IVV for the S&P 5, and IVE for MSCI EFA. EFA, for those not familiar, is just all the developed markets outside of the US. Okay. One other point to note is just in terms of cost, and I'm not very familiar with the cost base in Australia, but if you look at the cost of trading those two ideas to get global equity exposure, you're looking at around just under 22 basis points per annum. So if costs are similar, and you know, each of your client portfolios may differ, but hopefully that will look like fairly cost competitive exposure to get global equity exposure. But if we look a bit closer, what do we notice? Well, first of all, that is 50% to the US. So if you're looking for diversified global equity exposure, that could raise the question, do you want 50% in the US? You know, it's a very important market, but just something to think about. The other point is, and I'm showing my biases here being based out here in Asia, is of course the emerging markets. The MSCI World Index, by definition, is developed markets. It's completely excluding all those emerging markets out there. And finally, very definite home bias from my perspective, very little exposure to Asia-Pacific if you look down the list of countries there. Well, that's fine, Anthony, you may say, but, you know, does that really matter? You know, I'm going to have emerging markets, don't have Asia-Pacific, but does it matter? Well, to take a look at that, we thought we'd pull together the actual data. Now, I do believe strongly in the maxim, you know, past performance is not necessarily a guide to the future, but it does give you some idea of what could have been. At the end of the day, it's the real data that we can, hard data that we can look at. I've just got here, I've used the iShares returns here as a proxy for the index returns for illustration because we have easy access to the data. I've got the developed markets down below. That's the S&P 500 and that developed market index, EFA. And then I've just shown for illustration the emerging markets in China over that same period. So I expect none of this comes as much of a surprise to you. Over the last 4 or 5 years, clearly, you know, China and emerging markets have performed strongly versus the developed markets. I can't guarantee that's going to happen in the future, but it does raise the question, would it have warranted a position in your clients' portfolios 4 or 5 years ago? What would have done to your portfolio risk? And if it would not have increased your portfolio risk by that much, given the potential, would that have been worth an allocation? So we're going to pose the hypothetical question. Let's assume that it does matter. We do want to take a look at, you know, shifting, tilting the market weights around from the market weights in the MSCI World Index. So what we'll do is we're going to think about optimizing. And as I say, we've used the mean variance framework. There are other frameworks you could use as well. These are the capital market assumptions that were set out in the paper. These are designed to be long-term market equilibrium, market neutral assumptions set by BGI. You could come up with your own assumptions, and if you wanted to, you could work backwards in the market portfolio to see what market returns are implied by the market as well. So please don't focus too much on those numbers for today's session. They're really just there for illustrative purposes, but we'll have a look later at the real empirical data. So we run our optimization, and what do we see? Well, this is a chart many of you will have seen before, simple risk-return chart. The blue line is your classic efficient frontier, showing increasing reward for increasing risk. We've run this completely unconstrained. We've shown as the dots the different aspects of the MSCI World universe. So what we've done is we've broken down MSCI World into a few key regions, being US, of course, US large cap. We've also got Japan, we've got Europe, just so the optimizer can play around with the weights separately from what's already in EFA. The pie chart down at the bottom is our standard 50-50 MSCI World or World X Australia proxy. And what we notice is, of course, you can, based on our assumptions, improve the expected return at the same level of portfolio risk. So you can improve it by 25 basis points at that same level of risk. Now, if you look closely at the pie chart, you might be asking, well, what allocation is there? And actually, the gray area there, if you can see just here, is actually U.S. small cap, Russell 2K, and the green area here is Japan. So, you know, obviously, in practice, you might feel uncomfortable suggesting such large allocations to Russell 2 and to Japan to your clients. It's equivalent of building the theoretical kite and then trying to go out and fly it in practice, but bear with us for the moment. So what can we do about that? Well, in the standard mean variance, as you'll no doubt be aware, we can put some constraints around that. So what we've done to extend the paper for the session today is put some constraints around Japan. We've put it at a maximum of 15%. You could choose other constraints, obviously. And we're just going to exclude a U.S. small cap from the equation altogether. So what would happen? Well, the frontier would drop down. That's not a surprise. We're putting some constraints on. We don't expect to be able to do as well as we could based on our assumptions. But the key thing, of course, is we can still potentially improve the return. Not by as much, but we could improve the return at the same level of risk. Okay, to try and wrap up this theoretical part and get onto the more interesting practical part, I'd like to explore here also the perspective of where you sit on the efficient frontier. Now, if you're your clients invested in the Minsky world, effectively you're accepting the amount of risk in Minsky world as your risk budget. Now, obviously, your risk budget may be more than that. I think this actually sits at around 15% per annum. If your risk tolerance is above that, you could actually afford to increase the risk of that core portfolio. And you've really got two ways of doing that. You could either move up the frontier, and you can see the allocations change there. You're getting more into the emerging markets. Or if you're not comfortable with that and you want to sort of keep this as your core portfolio, the other way to think of it is you've got some spare risk budget to allocate to some satellite investments. So you and your client can take advantage of some of the tactical opportunities available out there in the market today. And what we've looked at is we've modeled adding some China exposure, represented by the black there, to pull up that frontier on a tactical basis. Okay, you'll notice that's quite a lot allocated to China, and we'll talk a bit more about that later on. Okay, so with that in mind, that's all some pretty charts and stuff, but what does that look like in practice? What do the numbers actually look like? And how can we implement these solutions using ETFs? These are actual past risk and return numbers over the last 4.5 years. So as you can see, we started with the Minsky Wealth, just following the index, which we proxied with 50% in S&P 5, 50% in MSCI EAFE. As we showed, you could trade that using just two iShares on the ASX. As we went along, we first all ran the optimization. We saw that portfolio that theoretically is optimal, but obviously it's based on our assumptions. And, you know, you've got almost 50% in U.S. small cap and 31% in Japan. So that's pretty large bets. So we put those constraints on here. The higher risk core is where we chose to be higher up the efficient frontier. And the satellite was putting in 30% China. Now, you may be asking, why 30% China? Isn't that quite a lot? Well, again, that's from the theoretical framework. It turns out that by adding 30% China, that was the same level of risk as that a higher risk core portfolio. Now, the interesting thing is this. First of all, from a practical implementation perspective in terms of fees, and I have to admit, as an ex-consultant, this is something we were very bad at with our institutions before. We didn't really focus much on the fee aspect. I think with all the things happening to hedge funds now, that's much more in focus. But if you look here, we've got a basic 22 basis points for the basic two iShares trade. You know, even for the slightly more racy exposures, you're looking at around sort of just over 50 basis points. Now, if you look at the return, now again, this is just based on the last 4.5 years. It may not happen in the future, but it has followed a nice pattern of increasing returns as we dial up the risk. But that's not the important point. I don't know if China is going to outperform over the next few years. I don't know if emerging markets is going to outperform over the next few years. But if you look at the risk, the interesting thing is this. Minsky World, the actual annualized standard deviation came out at 13%, slightly below our estimate. Our assumption was around 15%. As we dial up the risk and add these riskier investments, you know, we added emerging markets. We had quite a bit of emerging markets. We added quite a lot to China as well, which has been quite volatile. And yet, at the portfolio level, this is not theoretical anymore. This is the actual annualized volatility of those portfolios over the last 4.5 years. So I think that's quite an interesting empirical demonstration of the portfolio theory and seeing if that kite would really fly. And of course, all those strategies can be very practically implemented nowadays using ETFs. What we thought we'd then do is then take a look at, well, okay, that's very interesting. How would they have fared versus the alternatives? Because there's a huge number of fund alternatives that you have available. So we took a look at how some of those portfolios would have done versus an active peer group. And I must emphasize at this point that this is definitely not an index versus active debate. In fact, we feel quite strongly at BGI and iShares that it's more about how to blend index and active together. So this is not about demonstrating that, you know, active managers are bad, you know, that you can't find a good one and you should definitely go index and you should definitely buy iShares. It's not about that at all. But it's about seeing how these would have done and how consistent returns would have been. So the peer group I've chosen, the data is from Morningstar Direct. And we've chosen all the Australian-listed open-ended funds investing in the world's large blend equity universe. And the bars on the chart here are the range of returns. So at the bottom, so year to date, the worst manager in the universe did roughly negative 6-7%. The best did, well, very well, wonder who that was, just over 20% year to date. And you've got that over 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 4 year periods. The black line here is our optimized core portfolio. And the orange line here was our slightly racier core plus satellite portfolio, where we'd added that 30% allocation to China. So the interesting thing is the optimized core has performed, apart from year to date, where it's slightly below median, it's been consistently top quartile over the last 1, 2, 3, 4 years. The core plus satellite has consistently been top quartile, including year to date. Now, again, I'm not suggesting that this is always going to be top quartile, but we'll get to the risk aspect later. I think the point is giving yourself the opportunity at the same level or a modest increase in risk level. I think the other thing that I should point out, because, you know, you could fairly accuse me, Anthony, you've just data mined this, you've looked for when this is going to be good. We actually just looked for as long a history as we could for the portfolios we had. You could try it over different periods, but the main point's the risk. And also, if I really wanted to massage the data, I would have adjusted for survivorship bias. I've not included the obsolete funds here. So this doesn't even include bad funds that have dropped out of Morningstar's database because they don't want to report their returns anymore. And the other point is we don't really see the persistency on this graph because those managers in the top quartile here are obviously not necessarily the same managers who are the top quartile here or here or here. So what would that look like? Well, just looking at that, we've looked at all the managers who were active in 2004. And what we find is that roughly 40% of the managers had excess returns during 2004. Now, clearly, the persistency drops off. If you look for managers who had excess returns in both 2004 and 2005, it drops down to about 15%, and it sort of drops off from there. So again, I've really got to emphasize, I don't want this to be against active managers. I do believe there are skillful active managers out there. I do believe you can find them, and I do believe they can be skillfully blended with index strategies as well. Also, I just highlight that, you know, just because there are the managers in here who've got 4 or 5 consecutive years of excess returns, I wouldn't necessarily say they are the most skillful managers. You know, the fact is there is noise in the returns, and, you know, managers who didn't get excess returns in a particular year, there's certainly no reason necessarily to fire them. But I think the interesting thing is this. If you go back to this chart, the manager's performance wasn't very consistent, but if you look at our very simple portfolios, we haven't really done a lot with them, and we simply tried to change the tilts within the basic index. And, okay, with this one, we did try and add quite a bit of China, but again, at a fairly similar level of risk. That has performed very consistently versus the peer group over the last few years, which I think is interesting. So what have we done? We've looked at some theoretical portfolios, but what actually happens with some real-world portfolios? We looked at trading the core using 2 iShares. We looked at trading an unconstrained core, and we saw we could do that with a simple 4 iShares trade as well. We then looked at the constrained core. What I'd like to do next is look at some real world portfolios. So Tom's let me know a couple of model portfolios that quite a lot of the PCAs out there are using here in Australia to gain international exposure. So I'll look at a couple of those. And then we'll look at a core plus satellite portfolio as well, which is looking for even more diversification than we saw with China. So we'll look at one with 4 different sector funds. All these tickers here are ASX tickers accessing different sectors of the market. And this is partly to address the problem of the 30% allocation to China, because, you know, to be honest, if I were in your shoes, I'd feel a bit uncomfortable, despite what the theory says, suggesting a client should put 30% in China. But really, you can think of it as a 30% allocation to satellite investments, not necessarily to China. And you fill that bucket of satellites with whatever satellite investments you want. And you can see here, I've taken a very simple approach. You don't have to over-engineer this. You know, I used to be a mathematician, do all sorts of technical stuff, but you don't have to over-engineer. All I've done here is simply split my 30% evenly between these satellite investments and just take a look at what happens. So what does happen? And the title of this slide is diversification dead? Because we've heard a lot about that. You know, I've talked with my ex-clients, you know, I talked with my ex-consultant friends, and everyone's saying diversification doesn't work. Look at 2008. We need a new model. Everything's falling down. Well, I disagree. I think the expectations about diversification were wrong. Because if you read the papers carefully, diversification never said you could get rid of all risk. All diversification said you could do was get rid of stock-specific risk or country-specific risk. The market risk still remains. You can't. I'm sorry, there's no magic bullet to that. ETFs are not going to solve that problem. And even hedge funds have problems solving that problem as well. And if we look at the evidence, let's look at first of the annual performance of these. So the two real-world portfolios I've chosen are a portfolio consisting of 40% S&P 500, that's the IVV, a 40% IVE, which is our developed markets, and a 20% to the emerging markets. That's a fairly typical portfolio, I think, we see in the market today used by real-world advisors. We've also looked at an alternative, which we also see in use, of 80% IOO and 20% emerging markets. That needs a bit of explanation. The IOO is the ticker for the iShares tracking the S&P Global 100. So it's 100 of the really big global multinationals around the world. So some advisors like to see that as a proxy for global equity exposure. You've got big global multinationals there. And finally, our core plus satellite portfolio. That was our core from before with those extra sectors thrown in and that allocation to China. So first of all, one other thing is the core plus satellite. You'll notice there's no yellow bar here in 05 and 06. That's simply a data issue. Some of those sector funds that we brought into the satellites here don't go back that far. But if you wanted to, you could repeat the analysis using indexes to see what the performance would have been if you had a vehicle to track those indexes. You know, as Tom said, you know, here in Australia, we're at the embryonic stage of the ETF industry, quite an exciting stage, I think, for all of you as advisors, and you'll start to see that product set, I think, grow, not just from iShares, but from the State Streets, the Vanguards, and everyone else as well. And that can only be good for you as the end consumers. But the really interesting thing to me is not this performance. I'm not trying to say, oh, this is much better. You've got to go and do this because you're going to get better returns. It's really about the risk. Because if you look at this, we're at, again, fairly spicy stuff in the satellites, and yet the overall, and remember, this is not theoretical anymore. This is not me making some assumptions, doing some fancy mathematics. This is actual annualized standard deviation calculated from the data from Morningstar. And you see the overall portfolio risk has not been very different in terms of standard deviation. Even in 2008, where apparently diversification failed, all the correlations went to one, you see the volatility of the portfolio were pretty similar. So, okay, it didn't really save you. You still lost money, but you made money on the up, and you weren't really losing much more on the down than you would have been in the MSCI world without those extra investments. I think we can even see that even more starkly. This is my final wrap-up slide before the conclusion, which is to break it down a little bit more. I apologize I don't have China here, but I've shown the developed markets and emerging markets. I think what's clear here is, first of all, if you look at 05 and 06, it wasn't because magically emerging markets suddenly became less volatile during those years. You see here, it was actually dramatically different. Emerging markets were almost double the volatility of the developed markets in 05 and 06. They were genuinely much riskier investments on a standalone basis. But here's the interesting thing. You look at the portfolio which added the emerging markets. And remember, we're not adding a small amount. We're adding 20% to emerging markets. That's a pretty decent allocation. The overall portfolio risk has only gone up from 8 up to about 9%. So you've added 20% of this very risky investment, and yet the portfolio volatility was not really impacted so much at all. And that's just what modern portfolio theory was really saying. And that's why I say it's not so much about tweaking and trying to go for the absolute maximum return. It's about understanding that your portfolio risk doesn't go up by as much as the individual risk of the investments. And, you know, 2008 is a classic. That's when apparently diversification really failed. All the correlations went to one. Modern portfolio theory breaks down. Oh, really? Because, look, the risk here looks pretty level to me for all those portfolios. So, again, it's not about over-engineering. It's really about diversification and not so much thinking too hard about the optimization. And the great news is, from the studies I've seen, risk tends to be more stable over time or easier to make assumptions about than the expected returns. Expected returns, as we know, is very difficult to make assumptions about. If we could do that, you know, I'd be running money myself. So finally, what am I trying to say? Well, there's really three key takeaways. The first one, maybe the most important, is focusing on that diversification, not optimization. So as I said, we've used mean variance optimization for illustration purposes, but I'm not saying you have to go out and do that. And there are other frameworks you can use as well. Common sense really wins the day. Secondly, you can implement diverse portfolios regardless of size of assets. You think back to the slide Tom showed, and that's kind of a glimpse of the future once you get more products listed here on the ASX. But that was a fairly complex looking portfolio. You know, as an advisor, I'd be thinking, oh my God, how much paperwork's going to go with that? You know, how am I going to fill out my statement of advice on that? But you look at it, you know, that was a $300,000 portfolio, not a very big portfolio. And yet you can implement it very simply with 8 or 9 trades. You know, if you do it on the ASX, you know, ETF settled T+3, just like any other listed security. And finally, the huge range of available ETFs enables granular diversity, so cutting it pretty much any way you want, by sector, by style, you know, by region or by single country. And you'll start to see more and more coming to the ASX, I hope, you know, with commodities, you know, precious metals and all those other kinds of investments. So I'd just like to take you back to my childhood one last time. And I used to go home for lunch. And one day my mum said to me, oh, you and your sister come back tomorrow and you're going to get a nice surprise. Oh, you know, great. We love surprises. We're kids, right? So we came back at lunchtime and she said, sit down in front of the telly. I thought, well, that's a bit weird. Why should you let us watch the telly? Oh, that's not a surprise. That's not very exciting. So we sat down, started to watch. And, you know, I was a very patient kid. So, you know, 10 seconds later, I asked my mum, where's the surprise? So she said, just sit down in front of the telly. So we sat down. And a minute later, suddenly my sister saw it. It was a color TV. You see, we'd had a black and white TV before, and suddenly we had a color TV. Well, what's the point? I think that's what's happening in the investment world. ETFs are opening up a whole color of spectrum of investment possibilities for you. Markowitz and Sharpe, when they came out with portfolio theory in the 50s, I think it was, they were really a bit ahead of the game because that was a great theory, diversification and all that. But in practice, you couldn't really fly the kite because you could maybe get equities, bonds, but you certainly can get the exposures you can get nowadays, not even in equity space. Now with ETFs coming, that opens up a whole spectrum and color of investing possibilities to you. So thank you very much, and let's turn on the TV.
Landis coming up. Okay, thank you, Anthony, very, very much for that. We're going to go into question and answers in a moment, but before we do that, we're going to have a quick synopsis of this paper from Amanda Gillespie of Lonsec, and she will also open up with the first question.
Thanks, Ian. Thanks for the presentation. I suppose my one-minute summary of the presentation and the key takeouts would be, first of all, we've seen a lot of presentations over the last 2 days about and discussion about needing to be more flexible and needing to, particularly in regard to implementing your asset allocation and indeed considering a full opportunity set of instruments to do that. And I suppose ETFs are obviously an extremely useful tool to add to the kit bag in terms of being able to implement, efficiently implement more flexible asset allocation views and get that diversification within your portfolio. I think as Anthony mentioned, it's certainly not, we shouldn't consider it a binary outcome though in terms of yes or no, you're fully exposed to ETFs within your portfolio and you've gone passive versus the active portfolio. I think that we can look to incorporate a blend of both instruments or active and passive allocations within a total portfolio. And probably another observation in terms of ETFs, I think particularly given the concerns we all had last year in terms of transparency of product, lack of liquidity, and accompanying that, I suppose, the cost you're paying for active performance when returns were being eroded, certainly the opportunity to consider ETFs is a positive one. I think the issue that we face when we're implementing, deciding how to use, if at all use ETFs, and the issue advisors face is what that trade-off should be between cost and the lower cost of something like this and the liquidity and transparency versus the higher cost of active management and the opportunities, I suppose, that you're aiming to achieve via active funds. And so I suppose that's a bit of a trade-off that will obviously vary depending on different circumstances. And I suppose my view in terms of where you might look to use ETFs, particularly I suppose given some of the comments we've seen about the ability to add value in emerging markets and the comment this morning about the potential limitations of the emerging market index in terms of its cap weight to a concentrated few stocks would be maybe it is in those lower alpha markets such as developed markets and you use active managers if you're going to use a blend in those higher alpha markets like emerging markets. I suppose just to pose the first question in relation to this session would be with Australian investors using the international the MSCI ETFs, what issue, I suppose the issue around currency and that hedging, the exposure to, if you're wanting to use these kind of products but not have that exposure to currency, how that is dealt with?
Yeah, I think that's a good question, and I think it comes back to my earlier point about the fact that ETFs are almost always used in conjunction with another vehicle. And with ETFs in Australia, all of the ETFs are unhedged. And so there is currency risk associated with those. So typically, the advisors that we have using our iShares ETFs are using them in conjunction with another vehicle that will provide some hedging, whether that's a dynamic hedging or a set static hedge on a portfolio that might be an unlisted managed fund. So we typically see advisors split their global portfolio between unhedged and hedged. And increasingly we're seeing, our clients at least are using ETFs and iShares for that unhedged part of the portfolio.
Great. Let's get into the thrust of questions. It just occurs to me that what we've seen is a low-cost diversifying instrument that you can have building blocks and construct portfolios. They're called ETFs. So I go home tonight, and I have a young daughter, and she says, "Dad, what were you doing?" I say, "I listened to these really smart guys who are talking about ETFs." She says, "What are they?" I say, "They're exchange-traded funds." She says, "What's an exchange-traded fund?" I say, "Could you be quiet? I'm watching TV." Now, the question I'm going to ask the audience is, know your product. And this is, I think, it's a very important aspect of this whole session with how we use things in portfolio construction. If I asked everybody to stand up for a bit of fun, which I'm not going to do, if I asked you all to stand up and then I said, anyone who is uncomfortable with me saying, explain what an exchange-traded fund is, how it works, and where the risks are, if you're uncomfortable, sit down. Who's going to be left standing in the room is an interesting question. So I'm going to kick off the question saying, what is an exchange-traded fund so I can explain it to my daughter when I go home tonight?
Well, that's a good question, but and I guess what we've tried to do here is explain how advisors might implement exchange traded funds into portfolios. And we launched iShares our ETFs onto the stock market in October 2007, and we've had a lot of conversations with financial advisors across the country, and we have a lot of interest in ETFs. We have a lot of people who are telling us that they're very interested in implementing ETFs into portfolios. The critical question, though, and the question that we get asked a lot is, how do I approach this? How much of one ETF do we put into a portfolio? So, well, very simply, an ETF is an index fund that trades like a stock on the stock market. And so, and really, it doesn't. We don't want to overcomplicate what they are. There are intricacies with the structure, and that's a conversation that we have with financial advisors all the time. And it's a very good question that you ask. But we did assume some knowledge here today, and we assume that And the brief for our presentation here today was to explain how to use them in portfolios, not exactly what they are.
I've got again some comments, given that you turned up the TV question again. Yeah, pretty good one, nice one. I mean, I think if I was explaining to a kid, maybe I should try this on my kids later when I get back to Hong Kong, which is, I think I have to say, it's like having a prepackaged Christmas sock or something. You know, your Christmas stocking. Seriously, it's like, because it's basically a prepackaged, you've got someone selected the presents inside that Christmas sock already. And you can buy that Christmas sock in one trade at one price rather than buying all of the individual constituents at the end of it. And that's really what it boils down to. It's just a basket of things. And it's very important for us that those things are really inside. You can see what's inside. So maybe that's the selling point for the kid. You say, not only do you buy a Christmas sock with just one, you just need to write one thing on your Christmas list. You have to write down all of the things that you want. You just buy the package, and you can actually see inside the socks and see what's inside there as the presents.
And I think if I can add one more thing, we often talk about exchange-traded funds being the best of both worlds. What do I mean by that? Well, we're taking what we believe to be the best of index funds management. What would that be? That would be transparency, diversification, and low cost. And then what we're doing is combining that with the trading flexibility and liquidity that you get from buying individual listed securities. So I think thinking about ETFs as the best of both worlds from that standpoint is an easy way to think about them.
Okay, let's fire up. We're going to record the questions, so if you don't mind, I'll give you the mic. And question, not story, George.
Yeah, definitely a question. I've always been fascinated how ETFs can always trade at exactly the NTA. Now, you're offering international ETFs, and like in the China ETF, how many stocks are there in the China ETF, please?
25.
25 stocks.
Yep.
Okay, now, we trade that while China's closed, right? And there's a shock on Wall Street. You've closed, Wall Street's open later. Big, major shock. Interest rates have exploded, market's down 30%. We now want to cash in every client in that China ETF traded here in Australia. And you guys have got to buy it back off everybody at that stated NTA. But you guys can't offload it because everyone in Beijing is asleep. So how do you buy it all back when I'll cash all my clients out on that phenomena in New York? You guys can't sell the stock into Beijing. Those 30, I'm getting out at 20% above your stated NTA. How do you deal with something like that?
This is a really great question. The whole issue of how does the ETF price versus NTA, as you put it. Well, we often talk in Hong Kong about NAV or net asset value. I think what you're talking about is really, we refer to it as a price discovery mechanism. So when the vehicle itself is trading in a different time zone to the actual underlying, you know, often, as you say, it may look like it's trading at a big premium or a big discount, but actually all that's happening is pricing in all the market information up to that date. And I guess your concern is, well, what happens if the news happens when I'm in the market that's shut? And that's the problem. I mean, a lot of people see it the other way and say, well, look at the positive note. ETS gives an opportunity to get into a market when the underlying's shut. And we saw that happening with India recently. You know, after the Indian elections, the Indian markets shot up. I mean, it triggered all the circuit breakers on the exchange. The underlying stock market closed. And we were getting loads of orders for MSCI India trading on the Singapore Exchange and Hong Kong Exchange to get in. No, of course, no. We kept trading going during that time until the stock exchange said we have to stop that, because in essence it's just a price discovery process. Another great, yes. So in other words, the price. I wouldn't say. So who's getting screwed? Because our ETFs are available to all investors at the same time. And if you're really concerned about, say, China during that time, that's the other great thing. Don't forget that for IZZ, that's a cross list of the US. So actually you've got essentially the same instrument available for trading in the US, so a slightly different time zone. So in theory, if your clients had access to that market, they'd better trade that on there as well. So it's just different markets for the same underlying security and reflecting all of the available information at that point in time. And, you know, if you're in a China mutual fund, I'm not sure how often that would trade, but you could be in even worse shape there as well. Yeah.
So basically, the answer to the question is you could potentially have structural problems you're going to have to deal with in the step if you're going to go into the ETF. That's the answer.
I would say at the point, you might not be able to get out when you want. So let's say world blows up, you know, China stocks start doing funny things, but you're in the wrong time zone, so you can't, so the ETF's not open for trading yet. So that's a scenario. You want to get out of the ETF, but you have to wait for your market to open. Meantime, China stock prices are tumbling. It's true that you can't get out until the market opens, and maybe you have opportunities to hedge it other ways if you can access those other markets. What I would say is, at the point the market opens and you can sell, it'll be fair for everyone because the selling price at that point will reflect the market information at that point in time. Yeah.
Hi, thank you for the presentation. I just had a quick question regarding the transparency side. You can see the transparency in the ETF, but if you actually want to tie the ETF to an active manager within a particular sector, you don't really know what the active manager's got in their portfolio. So have you done any work on the likelihood of duplication and to what extent duplication is likely to going to be there?
So if I understand the question correctly, it's... So we're claiming transparency in the ETFs, but if you had an ETF that held underlying active funds, then how would you know what the active fund's doing? Is that what you're saying?
ETF. Yeah. Plus using an active manager,
so you don't really know what the
active manager is.
Oh, I see. Sorry. Yeah.
So it's only worth finding whether or not there is duplication, to what extent there is duplication.
I think what that comes down to is understanding, I mean, hopefully, the managers that you pick for your clients' portfolios, you will understand what's in there to suggest that active manager in the first place. Yeah, I know it is a difficulty. There's not a lot we can do about it. I do understand what you're saying. I've been trying to do some work, you know, comparing some of the active managers with the ETFs and seeing how to blend them. To be honest, the only real way I can do it is more from a returns-based perspective oftentimes. So you can do the returns-based style analysis kind of work to try and figure out what's going on. And that also helps me from a risk-return perspective, because when I'm doing the blending, I'll often try and see how it affects the risk-return of the portfolio. So the actual holdings, as you all know, it really depends on the funds. We often use a Morningstar Direct at the moment. We're finding that very helpful in the Australian context here, sometimes when we're comparing funds with funds. But often, for us, it turns into more of a returns-based type discussion. And with clients, all we can really do is try and give some advice around how you could blend them. And, you know, if you're an existing iShares client with size, you know, my team potentially now can offer help in looking at that blending process. But it's more from a returns-based perspective. Although, if the data is in Morningstar, then we could do some holdings analysis, which obviously you could do as well. Yeah.
Bell's ringing. We've got three more minutes. Just a couple more questions.
As we saw from one of your earlier slides, there is an enormous number of ETFs available on overseas markets, whereas there's a relatively modest number available here, although increasing. Could you just comment on or provide some insight around the issue of Australian investors using ETFs from foreign markets, other than the ease of trading, which is less of an issue than it used to be? Are there any additional issues or investment risks?
Sure. Look, all of the ETFs, obviously, that we offer give exposure to global equity markets. And so, you know, I think one of the risks is potentially trading, is the trading and execution of these. The spreads can vary according to different times of the day and can vary when according to when underlying markets are open. So, you know, one example is, we see most of the trading of our ETFs happen in the afternoon in Australia because that's when more of the underlying markets become open. You know, Japan opens at 11 o'clock, China opens at midday, and so the pricing of the underlying constituents becomes a bit easier for the market makers because they get complete clarity on those underlying markets. So that's a potential consideration that investors potentially should be aware of.
The ETF at yesterday's price before Beijing opened.
I think you need to think about the ETF trading as the world spins. So take the China example. That trades in time zone in Australia, trades in obviously China, it trades in the US stock market. And so the pricing of that ETF is fluid. It's changing all the time. So just like BHP will open at a different price to what it closed on the Australian market the previous day, that's exactly what's happening with an ETF. It's reflecting of what the price of an ETF is reflecting of what the world view is of the underlying companies that make up the ETF. That's what goes into an ETF price, and that's constantly changing. And so, So, you know, if you think about when US closes, there's what, a 3 or 4 hour gap between US closing and Australia opening. Now, during that time, there'll be futures markets trading, there'll be after hours announcements in the US, and essentially the world view, there'll be currency movements, and essentially the world view of the underlying companies will be changing. And so, the China iShare will then open on Australian Sydney Stock Exchange, reflecting all of the current information available in the world at that point in time.